Good evening, everyone. Good to see you this evening, and glad you're able to be here with us. And tonight we're on page number 30 in the lesson book, question number 11. And maybe we'll get through this lesson tonight. If we don't, we'll finish it next week. We're still talking about prayer. Prayer based on the idea coming from Acts 2 and verse 42, part of that verse of where we were looking at what the disciples did when they came together and what the believers were doing. Question number 11 in the lesson book says, from the following scriptures, list different positions that would be scriptural to assume in prayer. So the first and letter A comes from 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 9, 1 Kings 8, verse 22, 23. So what was the posture in those verses?
Standing for the congregation.
Standing for the congregation and delivering a prayer. There'll be a little bit of repeating as we go through these. Some of these had a couple of ways listed. Psalm chapter 95 and verse 6, letter B.
Praying and worshiping and bowing down and kneeling before the Lord our Maker.
Yep, bowing down and kneeling. Letter C from 1 Kings 8, 54, Acts 20 and verse 36. What was the posture in those verses? Kneeling and hands spread towards heaven. I assume y'all had, in my absence, y'all probably had a discussion about the hands, because it was in one of the earlier questions, I think.
Yeah, 1 Timothy 2:8.
Yep, which we'll get to in letter E. What? Letter D, from Matthew 26, verse 39.
Prostrate your feet to the ground. That was Jesus in the garden. Or face to the ground.
Face to the ground, yeah.
I wrote face. I said feet.
Yep, it's face. Fell on his face. Face to the ground. And 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 8, 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 22, letter E.
Praying everywhere and lifting up holy hands.
Praying everywhere, lift up holy hands. And then letter F from 1 Chronicles chapter 17, verse 16, and 1 Kings 8, 22.
Standing before the congregation.
Yep. Yep, setting, I can't talk. All right, now let's talk about these just for a moment. Back through these. First off, if you take inventory through this, there's not much else left, is it? I mean, what would be left? Laying on your back? I mean, really? Well, we got face down. Oh. So
something that we've adapted in our culture is praying with closed eyes. We never really see that in Scripture necessarily, but that's something we've done to kind of shut out things of the world, as we sometimes say. But it should be known, it should be brought to people's awareness that that's not something that's binding, and that there's no Scripture that says you close your eyes when you pray, or that you have to close your eyes when you pray, but that's something people do sometimes out of respect for God. So.
Yep, the operative word there being respect. I look at this I'm not going to say all the way, but partly cultural, because different cultures show respect in different ways. For example, in our culture, this is a piece that has been lost in about two generations, at least two, and probably in the third one, is dressing up to show respect, that's pretty much gone from our society. Used to, people that came to church, they came dressed up as best as they could. And for the best, for some people, is there's not a standard that's the best for everybody, because it's different for what people have, because some are poor. Poor may not have as much as others. To me, I look at us as more equal today than we probably were 50, 60 years ago, as far as that part's concerned. But it was a big deal 60 years ago, 70 years ago. What you wore showed respect, because they would to show respect to someone at a funeral, they wore a specific type of clothing to show respect for God. They wore a specific type of clothing to show respect at a wedding. You just know several different things. That's lost on our society today. Is that wrong? I don't think it's wrong. It's just not what, the way we show respect anymore, or not an avenue to show respect anymore in our society. It is in other societies and other countries around the world. It's in the way you dress. Kneeling at one time in our society, kneeling in prayer was respectful. That was another way people showed respect to God as they were praying. We don't see that anymore. It's been bunches of years since I've seen somebody kneel in prayer in an assembly. Bunches of years. Well, I shouldn't say that. I saw somebody a few years ago, or probably a year or two ago, visiting somewhere, and the one I saw somebody out of the corner of my eye get out of the pew and kneel as the prayer was being led. Hadn't seen that in a long time. That's something that it's not done in our society anymore. Sometimes it's because of convenience. Can you imagine trying to kneel between these two pews?
Put your face on there.
It's hard to do.
Sometimes when people come forward, I've knelt down and prayed with them here.
Yeah.
That's, even though it's not binding, you know, one way or the other, you know, standing or sitting or kneeling down, but, you know, it is a posture of reverence. And that's something we shouldn't forget. Like, that's a key thing I think you're trying to emphasize there.
Yep, I'm just a long way getting around to it.
No, I don't mind you taking a long way around.
I guess where I'm headed with this is respect for God, number one. Number two is, what's your purpose? You remember the one that was praying with his face up to heaven and beating his chest, "Oh Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner." You remember that prayer? He was calling on the Lord to forgive him. And then you had in that same passage about the Pharisee who did what? Looked around. See who was looking. And so in that case, his posture, or the way he was praying, was not good, because it was not genuine or respectful to God, because he was doing it to be seen of men. And then the one who smote his breast and lifted his eyes to heaven was looking from the mercy of God. Where we're headed with this is, it's the attitude is more important than the posture. The attitude is way more important than the posture, being respectful to God and so forth. Now this idea, you know, letter E from 1 Timothy chapter 2 verse 8, lifting up holy hands, that's caused some people some heartache and stuff over the years, and some controversy because of denominationalism. I've also had been... What I find interesting about that passage is usually where you find the hand lifters, they don't lift it up in prayer. They lift hands in other ways, or other times, like in the songs or in the preaching or something like that. Whenever it's pretty specific in that passage, if you're going to go that route, where it says it in prayers when you lift the holy hands. I would that men everywhere would lift holy hands in prayer. And then I've heard it argued that would it be wrong for somebody to lift hands when they're leading a prayer? I don't think so, but what's the purpose of them doing it? Just to be showing out?
Lifting, like raising their hand?
Yeah, like raising your hand. No, like leading the prayer, lifting up holy hands as they prayed. You know, what would be the purpose?
You know, I think, and I wouldn't go too far on this one, but sometimes, you know, people get the feeling like they need to do a little more. And, you know, lifting their hands, or, you know, it's kind of, they just feel like they need to do that. And it's not hurting anything, like you said. But you're right, it's all about attitude. Yeah, I remember seeing somebody at church one time doing that, but you know, that fit him, you know, that fit that person. It's almost like he's putting his antennas up to come in more.
And I've heard people make that argument, say that was helpful to them to do that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when we close our eyes, you know, if I close my eyes, I can focus more. It's like more in my mind than if I'm looking.
There's definitely that outward thing that we tend to be careful not to overexpress in the church, which I kind of like in a way, because it's taking away from attention from men. Like, you know, that's a good thing.
Remember our purpose.
We try to veer away from that. But at the same time, you know, Jesus did this in Luke 24 and verse 50, lifted up his hands and blessed the disciples before he was carried up into heaven. The Apostle Paul did it when he knelt with the elders in Acts chapter 20. And of course, he mentions it to Timothy in his epistle to Timothy. So it's not something that we should necessarily shun. It's just something we should be aware of as to how people perceive it today, like you're trying to point out. You know.
Yeah, there's a cultural aspect to it.
You never see me do it in assembly. Like, that's not something I'm typically going to do in an assembly. I might do it at home or something like that, or I'm definitely not going to do it driving either. Keep my hands on the wheel. But
that's right.
I need a Tesla.
Tesla.
Yeah, I can't afford a Tesla. But that perception, I think, you know, you're talking about earlier, the sinner. As a matter of fact, he wouldn't even lift up his eyes toward heaven, because in his current state, he was begging for mercy. He beat his chest, but he wouldn't even lift up his eyes to heaven. He wanted to, I think, in his heart, he wanted to be able to, but he wouldn't. Because of his shame and humility, he wouldn't lift his eyes to heaven, but he smote upon his breast and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And so whether we ever lift up our hands or not, whether we ever lift up our eyes to heaven or not, clearly that man's prayer was heard. And that's a key takeaway there, too.
The passage in 1 Timothy 2 there is talking about worship.
Mm-hmm.
Because it goes on later, says, suffer not, well, it doesn't say suffer not a woman to teach, but let a woman learn in silence, etc. And she's not supposed to teach, etc. The way I've been taught this by Bible teachers and so forth over the years is it's not talking about posture here. It's talking about men qualified. Number one, men. Not boys, not people that are not Christians, that have it, like we wouldn't call on slams in prayer in worship for obvious reasons. This would be your proof text for that. Someone that's living in adultery, they don't have holy hands.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, if you go back and look in the Old Testament, Joe and I have been noticing this a lot, Psalm talking about hands and God's hand, et cetera, right hand. It's really not really talking about the body part as much as just that you're not, your hands are holy. You're not a shedder of blood.
It's what you do.
Right, it's what you do.
It's what you do.
Because that's what you do with, right? Your hand, right?
Yeah.
So, you open doors with your hands, and so, there was a lady that was teaching one time, and her son was baptized. Church I went to. After some discussion with the elders, this verse was one of them used, 2 Timothy 2, and verse 8 was that he is now a Christian, and you would be teaching a Christian. And she was like, well, I'm his mother, I teach him in the house. That's a different
setting.
Right, different setting. So they
Yeah, and I think that was the right decision if we're going to be consistent.
Anyway, that's what I've seen it used before, is to emphasize the fact you just don't call on anyone to lead prayer and worship. You just don't. Females, no. Now, if they're just females in worship, of course.
Yep. And the thing you pointed out there, too, is this is centered around worship, this passage. That's what it's focused on. If our hands are not clean, then we should not be leading anything as far as worship goes, or even in the church, until we get our hands washed, until we get them clean. And it should be the same thing in prayer, based on what we've already studied, that if we have not cleaned ourselves, washed ourselves before God in prayer, then that's going to be a hindrance. That's going to be a hindrance for Him to hear our prayers. So there's a lot to this.
James 4:8 would be a good reference for that. Draw near to God, He will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. So
it's not talking about water.
Yeah, it's not talking about washing your literal hands. And that's another aspect. Like I said, we already did discuss, but I think that's the most important thing. That's what the Bible, like Alan's pointing out there, if they're not believers, if they're not living a Christian life, there's no way they can do this. Because otherwise they will have wrath for God, and their heart's not in it. So, but that's a good verse, I think, to note in regard to 1 Timothy 2:8. A good parallel verse is James 4:8.
All right. Anything else on that thought before we move on? I guess the moral of question 11 to me is what's your purpose, and are you showing respect to God as far as the posture goes? Number 12. This is one I struggled with a little bit. It says, name some ways in which you think public prayer in this congregation could be improved. And reason I struggled with this is because I don't feel that we have that problem here. I have been places where I felt there was a problem with prayer, because it seemed like you had the vain repetition. Because if so, brother so-and-so was called on, you knew exactly what they were going to say. And you always wondered, are they even thinking about what they're praying about? One of the things that I've been concerned with myself personally is behind the table at the Lord's Supper. It feels like there's only so many things you can say, because you're praying for a specific thing. So I've kind of thought about, how do you keep that from being a vain prayer? Or how do you keep that from being a repetition that's meaningless? Well, that would be a vain prayer, but how do you keep it meaningful? And so I try to have a mental focus that doesn't allow that to happen. And so there again, that's a conscious effort on myself to do that. What's some of the thoughts some of you others have? Or what'd you write down for this question? And sometimes what the person leading the prayer is saying will provoke a thought.
Yeah.
Provoke a thought, or provoke, like you say, something, oh, I'd like to add this to it. Yeah.
Yeah, you do that a lot.
Yeah.
Typically a lot.
And I think we sometimes, if we're listening to what's going on, I think sometimes it'll help improve our own prayer life because, oh, I didn't think of that. Mm-hmm. Or the variation of this, that's happened a lot to me a lot over the years.
I think for mine, in my own reflection, are four things I need to improve on in my prayer life, which is how I was trying to look at it. But also, there is one, the B one that I put down that I wish was more prevalent in the Lord's church. The second one I put down was all men being more willing to lead in prayer and worship. I know you agree with that one.
Oh, yeah.
There's been so many men through the years that could have helped and served and been a blessing and encouragement. Some people, which are eloquent and could pray, but they don't want to for whatever reasons. And so that's something that's always bothered me. And I know it's discouraged other brethren because I've heard this from other brethren before. So I wish all men were more willing to step up to that responsibility and that honor that God, you know, gives us in leading the worship. That's one thing that I noted. And then the rest is toward me, increased faith, because we all need to grow stronger in faith, increased scope of concern for our fellow man, especially the lost, more prayers with the true intent of let thy will be done, and visiting the sick and shut-ins would increase the intensity of our prayers toward them. COVID-19 has hindered this. So this is just my personal thoughts and my own reflection and things that has that I see I need to work on. So that's the way I try to approach that question. So that's not directed toward anybody else in this room, but just stuff I need to grow stronger in and increase in.
Well, some of you ladies think about this. Sure. That's a good thought. That's a good thought. You don't say a woman? Oh, you're not in Congress. You're not.
I make my kids do the same thing. At prayers, if they don't say an amen, to me, that's disrespectful.
David yells at me, or Sam yells at me if I don't say it loud enough.
Really? Yeah. So it's kind of a long-standing tradition in our house.
Mm-hmm. Number 13. Or did anybody else have something else they wanted to add? Number 13. Name some things that parents can do to help improve the atmosphere of prayer in the public services.
What does it mean by public services?
Just here. What could be done at home to help improve here? As far as I think the implication here is, since it says parents, is with children. One of the things I thought of is what Jesus done, you know, in the model prayer, is teach children what to say. And the second thing I listed, is practice with your children, and then lead by example. And the nieces and nephews, since I don't have any children of my own, they, I guess when they came along, and the oldest one was boys, so it was a little different than when the girls came along. It was kind of like, ooh, how do we deal with this? And so what we ended up doing a lot was we would help them. Tried to help them to say a prayer for the food, say a prayer before they go to bed, do all this other stuff, and let them do it. And to try to help them learn how to pray and do different things like that. And now I feel, thinking back, I feel a little guilty. I said we probably put more emphasis on them than we did the others. But we did that. But anyway, that was some things we did. And they're getting, one of them is not really old enough to understand, but the other one is. And so one of the things we like to emphasize to them is to have a meaningful prayer. Don't just say words. Say what's on your mind, what you want God to hear or to petition Him. And I realize with the little ones, that's harder to do because to that point yet of understanding. What's some other thoughts you guys have? Y'all are way more experienced. The way I look at it is you're planting the seed, the seeds of thought. We several years ago, and we had a much larger number here. We got some criticism from a couple, maybe just one, maybe one or two people for the Bible Bowl of all things. They didn't think we was doing it right because for several years in Wilson County and a few in Smith County, once a month you had or I can't remember if it was a month or a quarter, but anyway, we had competition. So Rome, Stan Stevenson at Rome, was the ones that most time come up with the questions, and I think it was a 100 question thing, you know, you filled out each time, and you did it as a group, and all that. But there was a lot of preparation went into that. But, you know, we had a team here. I can't remember. It's like we had seven or eight participants, and so anyway, we had time reeling and memorizing, because it was, you know, basically memorizing things. And so the criticism was, but you guys not spending time in application. You know, we're talking a spectrum of age of somebody about 12 years old up to about 16 or 17. So, you know, had a decent spectrum on age. And so I thought about what they said, and you know, a little bit, and we discussed it some, and they just didn't think it was right because you wouldn't discuss an application.
Were you winning?
Sometimes we did. We won one time. I can't remember. Too many years have passed. But anyway, I thought about it, and I said, and so I went back. I said, well, let's think of it this way. We're encouraging the reading of the Bible. We're encouraging the memorization of scriptures. Well, the hope is that those seeds of thought will grow and they'll learn the application. The application might come later. And so I kind of think it's along the same lines, same process here with prayer. It may be repetition at first, but we hope that the seeds of thought will grow into something to where it's not later on as they become of age and as they begin to reason more for themselves. Bending a twig. That's what it's about.
Well, there's a theory that came out that sounds like somebody kind of knew one of the teaching theories. I can't remember the name of it now, which was one of my favorite ones. But the bottom line is you have to learn, you have to have knowledge. Then you have comprehension, understanding the knowledge, and then you have application. And then it goes into analysis of the knowledge. Into synthesizing the knowledge, and then it goes into being able to evaluate. And I right now know the name of the person that came up with that, but they use that in school. So,
well, if you've ever learned a language, the easy part is recognizing the alphabet, whatever it is. That's the easy part. The easy part generally is pronouncing the words, or somewhat pronouncing the words. But the hardest part is comprehension and vocabulary and comprehension. I've heard that from a lot of people. That's where the time is spent. And learning the language, because if you don't know, you can say it all day long, and if you don't know what it means, it's meaningless. And I found that out with learning Ki Swahili. Myself, is it's not that hard to pronounce. It doesn't have that many letters, and they don't have that many words. So the pronunciation and recognizing the how to say it and all that's not that hard. But then the understanding, that's where the work comes in, and it becomes harder. Anything else?
godly and you make sure that worldliness is kept at bay in your home anyway, then there is a weightiness to God then. Your children see the importance of God. They see His glory.
The example's there, yeah.
It's not just a hollow prayer anymore. It means something. It's real to them. They see how He impacts your life and therefore want to know Him.
Well, there's a country music song, "I've Been Watching You," where the dad says he watches his little boy and he gets down by the side of the bed and folds his hands and says a prayer. He says, I asked him, "Where did you learn that?" He says, "I've been watching you."
Yep. I meant to bring that up a minute ago. That in thinking about the example is one of the things in relationship strengthening that we went through many years ago. I was taking some psychology things, and one of the things that they said to strengthen relationship is let your wife hear you pray for them, and then you hear your wife pray for you, and the same thing for the children. Let them hear it. Let them experience it from you. And I thought that makes all kinds of sense. Why don't people do this?
Definitely.
Huh?
Making kids pray for you too.
There you go. it's an important thing. Anything else on that? Oh, telling them to shut up.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think you got a kick out of it. But, yeah, that was a... I know that...
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Especially when you're young and you don't know what's right and wrong,
what's right. Yeah, I remember the 4-year-old going around the table, thank God for everybody sitting around the table. Then one time Kaylin got into the curtains, the windows. And, and then sometimes she would come up with something like, "Where'd that come from?" It's like, that was good.
I'll tell you, one of the greatest experiences with prayer I've had is a group of guys from Heritage Christian University. All of us were striving, we're studying, we're learning, we're doing mission work. We're engaged in serving the Lord, and these were genuine prayers that each person offered up. And each one of them was very different, but equally beautiful in the sincerity. And not only were we praying for each other, but for the church and, you know, for the work of the Lord to succeed, but getting to hear each person pray. We all took a turn to pray. And it still sticks with me to this day. Like, I have a fond memory of that moment. And it's etched in your mind forever. Because they're praying for you, you're praying for them, but also for others as well. Anything that's on their heart or mind at the time, someone was sick or something, they lift up their name as well to God in prayer. So it's just a very great memory. Perhaps we should do that more in our homes too, in regard to this question.
Well, do you remember what Wednesday night originally was called, or was called
prayer meeting?
Prayer meeting.
My grandma said that's what they would do. That's,
they came together to pray.
She said,
yeah, my grandma talked about that.
They would just pray the whole time.
Yep, my grandma talked about that. She'd be 107 or 8 if she's still living, but she talked about that. Have you ever been to an actual prayer meeting? I mean, you're talking about one, but I'm talking about like in an assembly type situation.
I have
a few times in my life. We got it where I lived a bunch of years ago now, probably close to to 30 years, 27 years ago. We had Brother Jones came in, did an all-day seminar, and he talked about prayer and different things to improve our lives. And did like one of those from 10 to 3 or 9 to 3 type things with lunch in between. And so some of them got together and said, yeah, we should do this. So Brother Kelly, he invited everybody over to his house. We had a prayer meeting one Sunday afternoon for about 2 hours. I was like, wow, I've never experienced this before. And then we did it another time or two, and then we had an issue come up, and so somebody said, well, let's just have a prayer meeting at church. So we did one Saturday afternoon, I believe it was. Not that, you know, roughly a third of the congregation showed up. And so there went another hour, a little over an hour, nothing but prayer. And then here, we've done it twice. Whenever we were asked to pray for the children's, I forget the specific thing, but dealt with the children's home. So one Wednesday night, we did a prayer meeting where the whole time was devoted to prayer. Not by one person either, by multiple people. And then another time we did it, it was specific for the nation. And I can't remember the issue that was going on that was bad. It might have been 9/11. I don't know. No, I wasn't here for 9/11. I can't remember what the issue was, but some issue for the country. And so it was decided we was going to meet for prayer one night. So we devoted one night, one Wednesday night, I believe it was, again, to having a prayer meeting. And we should be willing to do that whenever it's necessary. Probably good if we did it pretty regularly. I think it'd help all of us. Help us all.
Seems like the longer you pray, like as a group, but like if you actually take the time, not just saying an opening prayer or a closing prayer in the worship service, but really communing with God, talking to Him, casting your cares upon Him. It's and that's not in any way to slight or to insult our opening and closing prayers in a church service. But the longer people pray together, the more intense those prayers become. Because when you're putting that kind of time into it, it's going to start meaning something to you. You're going to start, you know, opening up more and more. It's just like if you talk to somebody, you know, you get a higher hello, but then if you actually take the time to talk to somebody, get to know them a little bit, it becomes a lot more real. You get to know them. It's very real at that point. That's when prayer becomes a lot more intense, and that's something that I think that you're pointing out that we're starting to miss in our, you know, that we're missing from those prayer meetings and other times where we've prayed for longer periods of time and for a lot of specific things.
Well, we have examples of it in Scripture.
Yeah.
Where they met to pray. General questions, true or false, before we run out of time. First one, Abraham married Hagar after Sarah died.
False.
Genesis 16, verse 3. They're both mentioned in that verse. Number two, Aquila and Priscilla were tent makers from Italy.
True.
Huh?
True.
Oh, I thought you said something else.
Acts 8.
Yep, Acts 18, 2. And now my grandma would say Italy. Number three, Moses' mother was named Jochebed.
True.
Yep, find it Exodus chapter 6, verse 2, as well as Numbers chapter 26, verse 59. Number four, there is a Bible book addressed to a lady and her children.
True.
That is the book, Second John. Haggai is the shortest book in the Old Testament.
False.
What is the shortest?
Obadiah.
It's just got a bunch of verses.
21 verses, and that's it.
Yep. It'd have to be like 7 or 8.
Oh, 2007.
Yeah, 2006, 7 or 8. We had it here
one time. Yep.
And his son, Chance.
Chance, yep. We worked with them on Wednesday nights. But that was, they were at the end of the group. They wasn't here when we was doing the big group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then we had it, then we hosted one time. And I can't remember. I don't think we won the time we hosted. But they won a couple times. A couple times,
oh,
got
yeah.
to bring the banner in.
And, I got one for you.
Yes, sir.
Who wrote more of the New Testament than anyone else? Nope.
Are you counting content, Luke? Yeah.
Luke. Words. And number of words.
Yeah,
yep, that's why I wasn't quick. That's why I wasn't quick to answer that.
Yep.
Just like, what's
Brother
the shortest?
White, Brother Joe White had all. He had one quick trick question like that for every single Bible class every day.
So, what is the shortest verse in the Bible?
Jesus wept. No, it's not.
Rejoice evermore in the Greek.
In the Greek.
It's got less letters.
Tricky.
Yes, that's a trick question. That's the one I'm surprised that not many people have discovered. All right, anything else? If not, we'll end right here and pick up with lesson number 10 next week.